Daher um Shabbat, Paramahansa Paribraja, Vicharaja, Stavta Sisi Maharaja, Divine Grace, Chidananda Goswami, Vivaya Chandra, Vinda Bhakti Vinanda Swami, Srila Prabhupada ki, Sukhan Chaitanya Chandra Daya Mandiya ki, Sri Sri Radhamadava Astashaki ki, Sri Sri Panchatattva Bhagavan ki, Sri Sri Prahlad Narasimhadev ki, Sri Sad Goswami Prabhu ki, Sri Harinam Sankirtan Jagya ki, Sri Guru Parampara ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki, Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga, glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Prasthaya Budhle, Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami, Nityanamini Namaste, Saraswati Devi, Gauravani Vachani, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, Prashachadi Satarani. So, yes, as I said yesterday, we are going to try to finish this course today, because I have personally a lot of other things I have to do, and we have just one more chapter or one more essay of material, and I think we can get through it. No need to drag it out. And so today we are going to look at the state of affairs in our modern world after having gone through, from the Vedic perspective, the nature of the mind and its workings. Now we can analyze the prevailing state of mind of the modern world. So Srila Prabhupada would sometimes quote an atheist materialist of ancient India, whose name was Charvaka Muni. So this Charvaka Muni was at odds with much of Vedic philosophy. But still his advice to people was that they should fully enjoy their senses within the context of Vedic culture. This is what Srila Prabhupada says about Charvaka Muni in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila 7, 119 purport. Quote, "It is a statement of Charvaka Muni that one should beg, borrow, or steal money to purchase ghee and enjoy life. Rinam kritya gritam pibet." Gritam means ghee. Thus, even the greatest atheist of India recommends that one eat ghee, not meat. No one could conceive of human beings eating meat like the tigers and dogs. But men have become so degraded that they are just like animals and can no longer claim to have a human civilization. So in other words, although Charvaka Muni was in many ways deviating from the Vedic culture, at the same time he did not try to invent a new culture to replace the Vedic culture. And that's exactly what modern so-called civilization and so-called culture is all about. That out of imagination which is arising out of the lower modes of nature, Rajogun and Tamogun, they're always trying to invent something new. Prabhupada commented on this in so many ways. That's what, for example, science is all about, technology. This whole conception of so-called progress, leaving behind the old and finding something new that is better than anything we ever did before. So, what this amounts to, what I argue in this essay, is a condition that for a long time, very long time has gone under the name of manic depression. Now it's known as bipolar disease. But basic to manic depression, manic depressive disorder, are conflicting moods. A person sometimes has a mood of high elation. He's very excited, even ecstatic. Ecstatic about what's coming to him. You see? Something new, something wonderful, something very exciting that wasn't there before is now manifesting. And so when he's in that state of mind, he's very excited, very optimistic. And then that alternates with moods of very low despondency. The patient may swing between these two moods. Or some of them have both moods simultaneously. One mood may be more prominent than the other. When the moods are extreme, the condition is called now bipolar disorder, as we said. When it's less extreme, they have another term, cyclothymia. They have so many terms for this. But I'm sure if Nitai Gauranga was here, he could give a lengthy and detailed explanation of bipolar disorder as it is understood today. But actually, it's not necessary for us to go into that because we can easily analyze it from the Vedic perspective. That mania, if we say manic depression, then manic comes from the word mania. So mania, if you look in the dictionary, it's defined as an excessively intense enthusiasm, interest, or desire. I'll say that again. An excessively intense enthusiasm, interest, or desire. That's right out of the dictionary. So that's clearly rajoguna, the mode of passion. When someone's intensely in the mode of passion, then they're very excited, they're very confident, they're very desirous of something to happen. They talk so much about it. You see, obsessed. Their minds are just fixed on this one thing. So that's mania, or the manic side. And then depression is defined in the dictionary as, quote, the condition of feeling sad or despondent, a reduction in activity or force, a reduction in physiological vigor or activity. So that's clearly the tamoguna. When a person is in the tamoguna, then they're not happy, and the force, their vigor, their activities, all of that, both physically and mentally, becomes reduced. To be depressed, the more depressed one is, then the more inert one is, you see. Like, it's well known, people in the extremes of depression, like these bipolar people, when they're in the manic phase and they're all excited, they're running all over the place, they're talking a mile a minute, they're making plans, they're doing this, they're on the phone, they're, you know, just so busy, 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 excited, big smile on their face, you know, how we're going to go and we're going to get this done, that done. And then they get hit with the depression side of it, and the very next day they can't even get out of bed. You see, you just see them, they might have interested someone else, you know, and told them, come and see me tomorrow, first thing, 8 o'clock in the morning, and we'll get started right away. Okay, so then he comes to the person's place, and he knocks on the door, and there's no answer. So he tries the door opens, so he can go inside, and he looks, and he sees his friend, who was yesterday so excited, now he's totally under the covers. I thought you wanted to see me now. No, go away. Go away. Don't bother me now. But you had big plans. No. Get out of here. Go away. You see. So this is, as I said, they call it, in modern terms, bipolar disorder or manic depression. But from Vedic analysis, we just call it Rajuguna and Tamuguna. And it's a fact for the spirit soul, these two modes are particularly the diseased condition of life. Therefore, in Bhagavatam, Tamo Bhava Rajas. Yes. Chityatayanavitam stittam sattva prashidati. So, until one can overcome tarara jastamo bhava kama lubdayus chie. So, rajuguna tamo guna, which means basically overcoming calm, desire. Desire, calm, in its positive phase then is manifesting as rajuguna. And then, in its negative phase, because that's what Krishna says in Gita, kama esha, krodha esha, rajuguna samudbhavam, tied together with rajuguna, is kama and krodha. So the rajuguna has these two features. Kama, so this, yes, excitement, excited desire, I want, let's go, let's get it, enthusiasm, but also produced out of the same rajasic mood is krodha, which is actually then rajaguna degrading into tamaguna. As rajaguna, because the one who's in rajaguna is never going to fulfill his desires. Those desires are impossible to fulfill. They're creations of maya only. So he can never fulfill them. So as he realizes that, he starts to become depressed, more and more disheartened. He loses his enthusiasm. So both, the seed of both is coming out of the rajaguna, but the end result then is that one slips down into the tamoguna and becomes inert, inertia, just doesn't want to do anything. So a person with this manic depression, manic depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, is just someone who's very much under the grip of the lower modes of nature. Practically his mind has become like a ping pong ball between rajaguna and tamaguna. Just tok, 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 tok. You say clip, clop, clip, clop, clip, clop. 1 minute all excited, the next minute totally suicidal, and then again, and then again, you see. So, when the Sindhya steamer Jaladuta docked in Boston Harbor on September 18, 1965, Srila Prabhupada wrote, Boro Kripa Kaile Krishna, or in other words, Markine Bhagavad Dharma. Which means, in Bengali, Bhagavad Dharma, or preaching Krishna consciousness, Markane is the Bengali way of saying America, so in America. Boro Kripa Koile Krishna. In verse 3 of this poem, we find this line, Rajastamo Guna Erasabai Achana, which translates as, all of the people here are covered over by the modes of passion and ignorance. So, I want to quote now from a very interesting article. I'll be quoting from this sometimes, that I found on the internet. It was written in 1997 by a Catholic professor, an important Catholic professor, teaches at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. And he wrote this article called, very interesting title, The Imaginative Origin of Modernity. In other words, what that means is that what we call modern life, or modern society, modern culture, it's a product of the imagination. It's a creation of human imagination. And then the subtitle is Life as a Daydream and Nightmare. So this is a very apt title. It goes very well together with everything that we've learned in this seminar. Some of you have been attending this seminar daily and have heard every class. So you'll see that this, what this professor writes, fits together. He's actually writing from an intellectual Christian point of view, and giving very good arguments and examples why modernity, it's not really something that's objectively existing out in the world. It's a state of mind that millions and millions and millions of people are just sharing through media, basically through media, through, which means, what is media? Media means the Asuric Sankirtan. You see? If Srila Prabhupada's vision was that devotees should engage film and television and radio, and just like Prabhupada did very early, he made a record, the famous, under the Happening label, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, and on the other side was Samsara Dhavana Lalita Loka, that first Prabhupada was playing on bongos. And he had his early followers singing behind him. Very, actually, beautiful kirtan, which George Harrison, somehow he got a copy of this record, and this actually prepared his heart, because he used to listen to this over and over and over again. This was before he met the devotees. And then when he finally met Shyamasundara Prabhu in the Apple studio headquarters in London, Shyamasundara was going there every day just on the hopes that he would meet George Harrison. And one day the Beatles were in and the whole place was crowded, and Shyamasundara was sitting there in this crowd. There were all these hundreds of people all having appointments to see the Beatles, and Shyamasundara had no such appointment, but he just somehow got in there. And then it just so happened the door to where the Beatles were staying opened, and George Harrison looked out, and he looked around, and then he saw Shyamasundara sitting there, and he just looked at him for a long time. Then his head went back in, closed the door, and then a little bit later he came out and he walked through all those people. I mean, all these, you can imagine all these people, George, 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 but he was just, and he walked right up to Shyamasundara and he said, "Where have you been? I've been waiting to meet you." And then he brought him right in. And this was because he was prepared by hearing this LP that Srila Prabhupada cut in 1966. So that was Srila Prabhupada's vision, that there's all this modern, up-to-date technology for mass communication. Now we even have satellites. So you have instantaneous television transmission between continents, CNN and all of that, BBC, all around the world, linked up. So Prabhupada's vision was all of that should be engaged. All of that is an opportunity for preaching. So devotees shouldn't reject it, devotees should engage it. But of course the problem is that most of these resources are in the hands of demons, and demons are well known to be situated in Rajoguna, Tamoguna. Those are their favorite modes. So therefore, out of this mass media, there has come this concocted idea, this imaginative idea of modernity. It's simply an idea that millions and millions and millions of people have been buying into for the... Actually, the concept of the modern world is also not that old. It really goes back... Really, the modern world started around the beginning of the 20th century. There was a revolution in physics, relativity theory, and quantum physics. It started in the early part, so there was a change of science where everything became relative. Instead of being fixed out there in concrete laws of nature, then our understanding of the world became more and more decided by what's going on up here. The way we see things, that this is what the relativity, without even getting into the scientific complexities of relativity theory of Einstein, that's basically what it means. That it's all a matter of how you see things. And so, two people can see the same thing, and they'll see it differently because of their different perspectives. But it doesn't mean that one way of seeing it is true and the other is false. Both ways are true, even though they may be contradictory. That's relativity theory, and from that we get relativism today, is that, you know, it doesn't matter, man, you know. Well, that's the way you look at it, but I look at it differently, you know, and someone else looks at it differently, and everyone has a right to their opinion, you see. And then these ideas, which began as scientific theories, and another important contributor to the modern ideology was this philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who was also arguing the same thing: there's no absolute truth, God is dead. So these were ideas in the early part of the 20th century, but still people in the main religion was still very strong, and the old ways, you know, the old moralities, it was the Victorian era. So these things were very strong up until the First World War. And when the First World War happened, that kicked out all the foundations of that 19th, by 19th century I mean the century before, the previous century, that sense of there's an objective reality. It was dealt a very severe blow. And Prabhupada also pointed out that the First World War, that was one of the great impetuses for India's, you know, the movement for independence in India, because the British brought in so many Indian soldiers into Europe. And the Indians had been trained by the British in India to look up to European civilization and to think of their own civilization as being inferior. So better to become more like an Englishman. And then there they were in the trenches, in the mud, and this industrialized warfare, you know, machine guns. What is that? You know, it's a weapon that's actually a machine. You know, a machine for dealing death. You know, just spitting out bullets by the hundreds every minute. And huge cannons and, you know, airplanes. Airplanes came in the First World War, dropping bombs from the sky. So mechanized death, and all very random, just people being blown up here and there, arms and legs flying everywhere, and there you are in the mud with the rats and body parts falling out of the sky on top of you. And so the Indian soldiers went through this, and they came back to India with a very different impression about European so-called civilization. And so was really the start when Gandhi's movement became very strong just after 1918 in India. So anyway, many changes. In America you had the Roaring Twenties. That's what all the symptoms of what have now become quite commonplace. They all appeared in the 1920s in the United States. Crazy music, like no one had ever heard before. Of course, it's different from the music now, but in those days, that was the wild music, this wild jazz, very fast music. People dancing crazy dances. See, women with skirts up to here. And, everything. Radio. They just started to invent television in the 1920s. Movies were coming out. So all these things started. Culture of violence, gangsterism. So all these things became very widespread. Along, yes, with the spread of modern media. So then new theories of what, you know, newer atheistic theories of science and philosophy and politics and so on and so forth. So this is this Catholic professor's point, that modernity is really a state of mind. So I want to read. I was really impressed by what he wrote, so I hope you are similarly impressed. So he writes, on the one hand, modern man uses his imagination to an unparalleled extent to evade the hard and painful task of moral responsibility up close. He always dreams of happiness on entirely different, far easier terms, of a life that can satisfy all his pent-up desires. As long as he indulges this imagination, he is intoxicated, inspired. But just as often the dark side of life seems to him to be all there is, and he despairs of happiness, bitterness, and pessimism torture him. So you see, if you look at the past 100 years, you know, when communism, for example, or Nazism, the Nazi movement, when they were new movements, that they were promising heaven on earth. That's why they became so popular. You see, don't think that communism. Of course, we look upon communism as a cruel dictatorship. There were these iron-fisted old men on top forcing it on everyone. But that's not how it started. And we think of the Nazi movement of Adolf Hitler, death camps, and, you know, people being gassed. But that's not how it started. How it started was young people with, you know, blooming red cheeks and marching in the streets and waving signs and, you know, giving the salute. You know, for the communists, it was the fist in the air. For the Nazis, it was this. And they were marching and singing songs and very enthusiastic, because they really thought that these new, and they could be, because these were two youth movements. They were movements of young people, just like, you know, those of you, you know, any, whatever generation you come from, you know, in, you know, as you were growing up, there were also similar, some kind of movement among young people that was capturing imaginations of many of people of your age. So in those days, these were very prominent youth movements. And they were promising a whole new world. A world of purity, a world of equality, a world of no more injustice, a world, you know. And but like he says here, the philosophies of these movements actually evaded the hard and painful task of moral responsibility up close. Because if you're going to change the world like that overnight, you know, if you got all these young people marching enthusiastically, and within 10 years the whole world would be different, what about all those people who are not going to be so quick to change? What are you going to do with them? You see? Up close. You know, getting into the question, what are you going to do with all those people who aren't so fascinated with your movement, you know, who don't want to wear your uniform and wave that flag you're waving? You know, they belong to an older generation, or they just have they're conservative religious people, or, you know, for whatever reason, they're not enthusiastic like you are. So if you do take power, what are you going to do with them? So in both cases, in Soviet Russia and in Nazi Germany, those people who didn't agree got very quickly sent up the chimney in the form of smoke. And they had some ideology to justify that. They were actually drawing from Darwinian evolutionary theory, both both these movements very heavily leaned on Darwin's theory of the survival of the fittest. So if you're not fit, then you deserve to be replaced. You're just taking up space. You deserve to be removed. You see? But like Nittai actually gave that example of that one special police force. They were average German policemen who were not committed to National Socialism, but they were given the job of ridding whole areas of conquered Eastern Europe of Jewish population. And at first they found that responsibility very nauseating, because all of their upbringing went against it. They were given orders, you have to go into this village and you have to kill everybody, shoot them in the back of the head. And so, you know, they'd have to get drunk before they did it, and then they'd do it, and then they'd vomit, and they'd feel sick, and they'd be crying. But the more they did it, the more they followed orders, then the more they became accustomed to it. You see? So in this way, these things, they catch hold. You see, the extremely sinful, extremely degrading trends, they're forced upon us by the personality of Kali. And people being surrendered to Maya, then they're surrendered to Maya in the first place, they're surrendered to sense gratification, they're dependent upon the society to provide their sense gratification, so then therefore they're obliged to perform such sinful activities, and by the end they get into them. Yeah, it's great. Well, we had a good time today. We murdered 300 people. It was really a lot of fun. So that means that the finer moral sentiments of the human being are, because of this modernity, are being erased. And Prabhupada writes about that so much. Prabhupada meant that when we heard earlier that quotation where he said that even Charvaka Muni could not foresee that human beings would become meat eaters, and therefore now, because they are meat eaters, they're just like tigers and dogs. So tigers and dogs, they don't have any conscience. You think a tiger, before it jumps on an antelope, says a little prayer for the antelope, you know. Oh, poor antelope. Now I'm going to break your neck and eat your guts. I'm sorry. No. Tiger just jumps. It's just, he sees the opportunity. Oh, here's this animal. And I'm hungry. He just jumps, kills it, and starts to eat. So this professor observes that mankind today has on one side a grossly inflated idea of his position in the world. On the other side, he is cast down into deep despair when the position he imagines for himself is not given the respect by the world. Modern man is therefore, this professor concludes, manic depressive. And Maharaj and I were talking about that this morning also. This is actually one of the trickiest aspects of the false ego. See, the false ego wants to inflate us to think that we're God on one side. And so we let ourselves get all inflated. But then, our practical experience in the world, this is the point that he makes, that this professor makes, that imagination becomes intoxicated and inspired, but just as often the dark side of life seems to him to be all there is. That's because, oh yes, he always dreams of happiness on an entirely different, far easier terms, of a life that can satisfy his pent-up desires, but that doesn't happen. See, it doesn't happen. The dreams that he's having don't come true. So the false ego builds us up. You're God. You're the supreme enjoyer. You're the center of everything. You're the most handsome man. You're the most beautiful woman. You know, the whole world will fall at your feet. And then you go outside, ta-da, here I am. And everyone's just walking by. Hey, get out of my way. What are you doing? What are you, crazy? You know? And then, what's wrong? What? Nobody's noticing me. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about me. Oh no, I'm all alone. Oh. And then one goes into all this existential grief and anxiety and